Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Roguecast number 172. From our brand new studio.
Yes.
In Suite 330.
So fancy in here and air conditioned. Again, I don't know if you can hear it, but we're basking in the coolness.
We're so much cooler. Physically speaking.
Right, yes. Right. Yeah, I don't want people getting the wrong idea.
No. We are no cooler than we have ever been. Anyway,
I'm going to tell people, there's a little kid pressing up against the door right now to the office.
Yep.
And I don't remember what movie it was for. I think it was maybe the 2003 Dawn of the Dead remake that had, like, kind of as its visual image. It looked like a frosted glass, like our door, with just the images of, you know, the faint wisp silhouettes of people behind it.
Yep.
She looked like a little kid zombie.
Yeah.
Just like that advertising campaign for whatever movie that was.
Yeah.
Anyway, other than that, though, it's really nice back here, except for the child zombies.
There's the child zombies. So we have a lot of events the next few weeks.
Yes.
So next weekend, July 22nd, will be Gaming with Rogue, King of Tokyo. We've got prizes this time, so definitely come out for that. There's some cool prizes in the tournament to play for that. And then we'll be doing back-to-back ladies' nights. Tila's bringing back ladies' night on Saturdays. So July 29th will be first ladies' night back. It is pajama-themed, so you can come in your pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to show a movie. I believe she's leaning toward 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah.
Basically, it'll start at 8 o'clock. And then the store will close, and it will continue after hours.
Yep, and it'll be like popcorn and other fun stuff.
Yep. And then August 5th will be the Queertastic Ladies Night, because it's Austin Pride Month.
Yep.
And she is bookending that month with a Queer Ladies Night, mm-hmm. although allies are welcome, so all ladies are welcome.
And I don't think we're usually planning to do back-to-back nights like that. It was just because of all our events, that's how things sort of had to tumble out.
Yes, exactly. Because August 12th, we're doing our 10th anniversary and grand reopening. We will have our sign moved by then, if all goes well.
That'd be awesome.
We will have...
People are finding us, though. I don't think we need to move it. Let's just be a thrift store that specializes in comics and games.
I think that's a terrible idea.
All right.
How about we just take down the thrift store sign and just be the comic shop without a name?
I don't like that either.
Rooks Gallery Comics and Thrift.
So, August 12th, we will do games, and we're going to have some geek trivia at night.
It's going to be the coolest.
Yeah, all kinds of cool
stuff. Should people already start kind of mentally preparing for their trivia team?
They might want to. We're doing team-based. We're doing Geeks Who Drink style, so it's going to be... We're not going to do buzzers or anything. It's
like
going
to
be...
Like four or five or something like that?
We're looking at four-person teams.
Yeah, you can go ahead and start scoping out your team there.
We're coming up with very hard questions.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I think I had one this morning, Randy. Remind me to tell you what it is after this podcast. It was good, I think.
Yep. So comic book trivia will return, and we're doing a different style, so that'll be a lot of fun. And then Gaming with Rogues, again, will be on August 19th. Don't have the game picked out on that one yet, but that's third Saturday, as always. And then we're doing our first ever Austin Pride Party on August 26th, which Teal is running that whole thing. I don't actually know what it all is, but...
She's going to handle all the events from here on.
Yep. But, so then, we got news. A lot of TV-related news, actually. But let's start with the comic book one, which is... They're doing a six-issue series called Harley and Ivy Meet Betty and Veronica.
Yes. Co-written by Paul Dini.
Paul Dini and Mark Andreyko.
Mark Andreyko.
That's a good combination.
Yeah. And the cover hilariously has Archie drinking a milkshake with Harley and Poison Ivy as Betty and Veronica look on.
Yep. And I noticed that I believe it looks like Harley was hogging the straws, probably the Betty and Veronica straws.
Yes.
So she had like three or four straws in her mouth. It's a crazy idea, but... These days, that's from Archie. That's not particularly crazy. That's
I was gonna say. Archie's
crossed
over,
is what they do.
Archie's crossed over with the Punisher. Harley and Ivy. Yeah.
So
I think it's a good call.
When are they gonna cross over Archie and Guar? That's
Archie and Guar is Gazmageddon.
Yes.
Part two.
I hope instead of choosing Betty or Veronica, he chooses Guar.
Apparently, Harley and Ivy kidnap Betty and Veronica because the Riverdale is going to destroy the wetlands as part of the city's expansion. And I assume that Archie's going to have to get involved with Batman rescuing them.
I remember reading them saying that, you know, Archie and his buddies are not They're not just sit at home kind of people. They're proactive. They're going to go and they're going to, I guess, crack some skulls to get their girls back.
Yeah.
I have this feeling that that Paul Dini and Andreyka will find a pretty fun story in this.
Oh, yeah, maybe Ivy just killing them all with gigantic plants.
And it took a dark turn. Did you say it was six issues, though?
Yeah, six issues.
That seems a little longer than I'd expect. But,
I would, too, yeah.
But I wonder, you know, where the craziness will come from. Like, are they going to have more Batman characters, meet more Archie characters, you know, in there? You know, is it just Harley and Ivy? Are they going to rampage through town? Are they going to blow up Pops's malt shop? Is it Pops?
Yeah, Pops.
Yeah, are they going to blow up Pops' shop? I hope so.
I don't know. You've always hated that malt shop.
They can call it the Pops shop op. I didn't just say that.
Yeah, you did.
delete it.
A couple bits of non-TV news, and then we'll just cover all the TV news. So, they have cast Randall Park from Fresh Off the Boat in Ant-Man and Wasp, and he is playing Jimmy Woo, S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Jimmy Woo, who, by the way, is an FBI agent in the comics.
He became a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, though.
I know, but he was an FBI agent first. In Agents of Atlas, he's an FBI agent. At any rate, this is kind of cool. We were talking about this the other day, that I would expect him to have sort of a cameo type thing, that it's going to be sort of a flashback in the opening to the early days of S.H.I.E.L.D., Jimmy Woo working with, you know, young Hank Pym and that kind of thing. And if that's all that is, I'm perfectly happy about that.
I saw an article that was kind of musing over the fact that this could be like a stealth bringing Agents of Atlas to the big screen. And I'm like, you know,
that would
honestly
be the ultimate last chance for Agents of Atlas.
They'll go ahead and make the
TV show. It's had like a dozen miniseries and comics.
They basically made Guardians of the Galaxy, which is kind of an off-brand kind of weird assortment of characters.
I am going to go on record right now as saying that it is not Agents of Atlas coming to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I can see M11 on the big screen.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
I think it could be fun. Whether or not it's going to happen, I think it would be... I actually think it would be great.
I also think it could be fun, but there are lots of things that could be fun. I'd love to see the D-Man movie. That's not going to happen either.
I give him time. Actually, D-Man will get a solo show at some point.
Yeah, you think? On ABC?
Yeah.
That'd be heartbreaking.
When Falcon becomes Captain America, he needs a sidekick. He'll bring in D-Man.
It's not going to happen. I mean, I know it sounds crazy because Lockjaw's going to be on TV, but I would rather know D-Man than ABC doing D-Man. I'll say that.
What if it was like CW sexy D-Man?
Okay, yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Yeah,
for those who don't know, by the way, D-Man is kind of a super-powered hobo wrestler.
It's funny that his name is D-Man, because he is the ultimate D-list character.
Yep, but it stands, for the record, for Demolition Man, because he's going to demolish your ass in the ring. That's
Demolition
what he does.
Dunphy.
Yep, and he's cool, and he's patriot, because he was a soldier at times, and he's got a beard.
Yeah. And sometimes he's a homeless, smelly person.
And sometimes he's a homeless, smelly person when Bendis wants to denigrate him.
No, that was Busick.
Was it?
Busick did that.
Oh.
He was the champion of the homeless.
Okay. Under Bendis, he just went crazy.
Yeah.
I think he was beating up people.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just, for the record, putting my money down that Agents of Atlas is a possibility.
All right.
I like to occasionally put down my money on like a Dark Horse thing that I'm inevitably wrong on.
I just think it could still be a flashback, and that could be a team that Ant-Man worked with in the past.
It's probably about
the Golden Age of superhero team.
He's not wrong.
No, you're not wrong. I believe we'll see D-Man on the big screen before we see the Agents of Atlas on the big screen. That is where my money.
You don't
lays.
Think? Is it possible they could be like a stealth Golden Age team?
Yeah, I think I think the possibility is there, especially with Phase 3.
Do we think it's more? Randy, do you think
arc?
It's more or less likely than my theory that Doctor Strange was going to get a more scientific explanation for his powers? That
I
proved
think
false.
I actually think it's
sort
less
of.
Likely than that. Because the Doctor Strange thing seemed like the kind of thing they might do.
Right. I think they threw out the barest nod to it.
Yeah.
There was some mention of, you know, magic is science to some people. There was like, but they didn't
one
even...
One little nod, but yeah.
One
there
little
was,
nod.
It was not...
I did not consider myself vindicated.
Yeah, that's good.
I consider myself a fool.
Yes. Me too.
Nobody's asking you, Randy. Nobody cares what your crap-ass thoughts are.
Moving on.
Nobody cares, Randy.
The next DC animated movie is going to be Gotham by Gaslight.
I thought this was a really cool idea.
This would be really cool if they'd made a single decent animated film so far.
I've, I've enjoyed some of them, so I can't.
I believe you're an outlier on that, Randy.
I know I am. I just they've all been disappointing to me. Even the ones. All right, that
so
I've
here's
liked.
Why I have to pop a hole in it. Red Hood. You liked? I know you liked Red Hood.
I did like Red Hood.
I remember you telling me that Dark Knight was pretty good.
Dark Knight was not bad. Dark Knight was okay. not bad.
Your Red Hood wasn't bad.
What I want is great.
Yeah.
I want Batman Animated Series, Justice League.
Anybody watch the Judas Contract one that they did?
Or? No, I heard it was only okay.
It looked actually halfway decent to me from the trailers, but for some reason I'm not quite. I don't know if it's just sort of basically everything sort of New 52 and onward I just feel a little detached from, but I haven't been keeping up with any of the DC movies. I can't actually say that they're good or bad because I just haven't been watching them. But
I actually want to watch the new one, the Harley one.
Interesting thing.
The Batman and Harley.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That one looked halfway decent because it was specifically seemed like it was almost a continuation of the 90s animated
They're almost
stuff.
All at least halfway decent. They're not terrible.
Yeah.
I just want them to rise above mediocrity.
So you're saying you'd rather watch one of the animated movies than the live-action movies?
Yes, in general, I think that's probably true. Unless that movie is Wonder Woman, yes, the DC animated are still. If there's a tier, if we're doing the tier system, the top level is all the Deanie Tim stuff, you know,
yeah.
Batman animated, Superman animated, Justice League, and then below that is the animated movies. Below that is Wonder Woman. Below that is nothing. And below that is Superman versus Batman.
Wow. What do you really think, Grant? I wasn't going to say. But Gotham by Gaslight. Story I like.
Yeah.
One of the first books Mignola did for DC, and I believe the first Elseworlds.
It was the first Elseworlds, yeah.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Gotham by Gaslight is Batman in sort of like, what, Victorian England? On the trail of Jack the Ripper,
yep.
Who, I shouldn't mention twists. They did do a follow-up to it, which kind of made it slightly more, a little bit more steampunk.
Yeah, before steampunk was really a thing.
Yeah, it was Batman Master of the Future.
Yeah.
And I actually found that, even though it didn't have Mignola artwork, it was artwork by Eduardo Barreto, if I'm not mistaken. I actually think I enjoyed that story a little bit more. It had, like, you know, a madman with, like, a zeppelin that had, like, a sun-focusing laser thing on it. And it was, like, very more steampunk.
Yeah.
I think Chuck Dixon wrote that one?
Or was it
the same guy who wrote...
Brian Augustine. And Brian Augustine.
Okay, yeah, he wrote the original. Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting to have two sort of linked Elseworlds out there.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any chance that this will... use elements of both. They always heavily tweak the stories. Yeah. I say always. They didn't like with Dark Knight, but they almost always did.
My favorite animated movies that DC did are the shorts. The Superman Shazam one, which I don't actually love the Superman Shazam one, but when it was coming out on DVD, it also had that Green Arrow by Greg Weisman, which is honestly, I think, the best one they've done, period.
Yeah,
and then it had that 70s Spectre, which is one of the best things they did. So what I would rather they do, I'd rather Gotham by Gaslight be a shorter movie and then have some other Elseworlds shorts that you couldn't do a full movie on, but could do a short, like, 10 or 15 minute thing. Like, a DC Elseworlds Blu-ray I'd be much more excited about.
That'd be kind of alright.
I'd love to see the Justice Riders.
Yeah, that'd be cool. And again, Justice Riders is probably a thing you don't need a full movie for. And I don't think you could sell it as a full movie. I think that if you had a DC Elseworlds Blu-ray or whatever that was 2 hours
of
three or four different shorts, I think it would sell better.
Now here's the interesting thing. It was long enough to be adapted into a movie.
Yeah.
You just think it wouldn't sustain kind of its pizzazz.
I think it would not sustain its pizzazz. I
kind of think that's true, too.
And do we know of any of the creators who are involved?
Like, no, I don't have any.
Because I know Deanie is not
but
completely involved.
I will say this. I would be kind of curious to see, you know, what I remember is that they did not do a ton in Gotham by Gaslight of what would later become like a total trademark of all Elseworlds stories, which is you don't see a whole lot of other Batman characters and allies and villains and stuff adapted into the Gaslight setting.
Yeah.
You know, there's Batman. Not like, oh, there. This is the Alfred of that setting. This is the Catwoman. There might be one or two of those people here and there, but there's not a ton of it. And I could see them expanding on that in the movie and adding a little bit of soap operatic so that there was a little bit more than just this is Batman in cool steampunk gear.
I hope there's a steampunk Superman that he beats the crap out of because Batman's better, apparently.
Oh my God, Randy, your cynicism is the biggest buzzkill of all time. I'm trying to talk this thing up and have some enthusiasm.
Yeah, I know, sorry. I'm just amused by the notion of that. I actually don't want you to do the steampunk Superman
Isn't that just Lex Luthor? Steampunk.
Yeah.
Well, he would be taking some elixir or something.
Yeah. He'd be like a Tarzan type, maybe from like a lost world or something like that.
That could work.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Moving on, we've got a bunch of TV news. The first one's very speculative and doesn't seem to be. It's probably more at rumor stage, which we don't usually talk about, but it's interesting. So, Gerard Way's Umbrella Academy is supposedly headed to Netflix. All this means is that there's like a report. Gerard Way is involved in some capacity. They might make an announcement at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
I love the Umbrella Academy. I wish that he'd done more of that. I really wish he'd done followed up Dallas with another one. There's rumors that he might, maybe if the TV show goes, we'll get another one. Which, if the TV show, regardless of its quality, if it gets me a third Umbrella Academy, that'd be great. Or if it gets me that library edition of Umbrella Academy I'm waiting for them to do forever, that'd be great too. I mean,
he's all working with DC now. He's too busy for more Umbrella Academy.
The creators listed...
Is this... I've never read Umbrella Academy. Tell me what it's about.
It is a dysfunctional family of superheroes. Children with extraordinary abilities who, under the tutelage of their adoptive father, Sir Reginald Hargreaves, spent their youth fighting crime, but then something went wrong, horribly wrong. 9 years later, the estranged siblings reunite for the funeral of their mentor and to face a terrible threat to the planet. I just made that up off the top of my head.
No?
No. It's in this article right here.
It had a little bit of the strangeness of his young animal line, right? His Doom Patrol stuff. Like that sounds like that could be a Disney Channel superhero series.
I think Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
I think the sort of dysfunctional family element of it all.
Now, is this a live action or an animated thing?
It's live action.
It had a very strong visual presence. Well,
The Gabriel art was, Ba.
Or, yeah, I remember the art was pretty stunning on it.
Yeah. It flip flopped. It was Gabriel Ba and his brother.
They both did
which was gorgeous.
Yeah. I would love an animated one, but I feel like it's probably going to be live action.
And the Netflix is who's doing this?
That's what they say. It was being developed for film by Rawson Marshall Thurber, you might know from Dodgeball and Central Intelligence. But he said it was too challenging to adapt for the big screen, which I believe. I don't know if he's going to be the one doing it. I hope not. It does say that it will utilize the script Jeremy Slater of Fantastic Four wrote. Fantastic Four, I mean, the part of the problem with Fantastic Four, of course, was that was the wrong tone for Fantastic Four.
I think it had more problems than just writing. I think that was more director problems and studio problems.
It's not necessarily a Death Note.
Because this guy also did something else, right? Yeah. Slater, he did
Death Note.
Netflix Death Note. Which looked pretty good. I'm hoping that's good.
So we don't really know. It's not promising. It's not like, oh, look, this great guy's attached to do it. But it's also not, this is going to suck. But we also don't know for sure what's going to happen.
Right.
I would like it to, though, because I think... I don't know if it'll adapt well.
I don't know. It could. It would have to be pretty large in scope.
Yeah, that thing is pretty wild and comic booky.
Yeah, it is. Honestly, I think in that case, animation is a better suit for it, but yeah. I don't know.
It's interesting, though, and like I say, I don't really care that much if the show's good or not. I just want them to get me more Umbrella Academy in the comics, and sometimes there's a show that'll cause that to happen. So, the Coen brothers are working on a show, which I feel like I should have known, but I don't.
Oh, really? I'd heard of this for a couple weeks ago, and it finally kind of congealed more today.
It is a Western anthology called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, 6-part series. Each episode will tell a different self-contained story with a different set of characters. Joel and Ethan Coen are writing and directing. This is the first time I've ever done TV. No doubt, probably inspired by seeing what happened on Fargo.
Which I think people... naturally think that they're involved with but they didn't even
all they actually did was say
read like the last couple like first they, pages they of the script like, yeah, they read and the then first they were page, like yeah like, whatever
go for it yeah that's they probably watched weird. It yeah
I haven't seen Fargo. How tonally Coen Brothers is it?
Very.
Yeah. It's so very much in the vein of Fargo. Of
like strange dark humor and then suddenly sometimes pretty grim and serious.
They have cast or they haven't cast, but they're getting close to...
writing and directing, I'd be all over that.
They're getting close to casting Tim Blake Nelson, James Franco, Zoe Kazan, Tyne Daly, Stephen Root, and Ralph Ineson. I don't know who Ralph Ineson is.
I recognize the name. And they actually did outright sign James Franco today.
Okay. So
Tyne Daly with Damage Control now?
Yes, she is.
What? Is that her?
That was her.
Yeah, that was her.
So Franco, Stephen Root, and Ralph Ineson will appear as an episode called Near Algodones, which is about a drifter who attempts a bank robbery and cattle driving, foiled by his own ineptitude. Zoe Kazan apparently stars in an episode called The Gal Who Got Rattled. Zoe Kazan is the second lead in Big Sick, which we're going to talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
Tyne Daly is in The Mortal Remains, five different characters journey to go to a stagecoach. They've got all names for all these premises. Like, clearly it's happening.
Yeah.
Sometime in 2018. We don't know where.
Coen Brothers, to the best of my knowledge, have only made one full Western, which was their remake of True Grit.
Yeah.
Has there been any others?
No, not full.
I mean, yeah, I guess Oh Brother, Where Art Thou had it was a little bit closer to the Old West than not.
No Country for Old Men has Western elements,
yeah,
but it's
true.
A modern day Western.
I think the themes.
Yeah, I think it's one of those, like, John Carpenter always described, he said, like, all of his movies are Westerns. I'm like, no, they're not. But he meant sort of in kind of their execution and their themes and their style.
Honestly, this had me at Coen Brothers Television.
Yeah, me too.
I was just like, that's a no-brainer for me. Yeah. I'll watch that. It doesn't say where it's going to happen.
We don't know where. We don't know when. Sometime 2018, probably FX or Netflix.
They should get Josh Brolin in there.
Yeah.
He's too busy being Cable.
That's true. And also Thanos.
And Thanos. Yeah.
And also something else, right? Isn't he like... Then he had multiple roles in various film universes.
I'm sure.
Is he not in the X-Men somewhere?
He's Gwenpool.
He's in X-Force.
I guess Cable makes him X-Force. X-Men.
Yeah.
Is he not in the... What's the other franchise? Is he in DC somewhere? He played Jonah Hex.
He did play Jonah Hex.
True. Busy man.
Try not to remember that
He
one.
Needs to find some... I guess he's been in some good Marvel movies, but he himself hasn't been... He's just been guest star.
Yeah.
Or...
He's probably going to be a pretty notable part of Infinity War.
You think? You think Thanos is going to end up being in that?
I think he might be in it. He'd be at the very end.
Yeah, I thought they were going to fight somebody named Infinity.
Marvel has its cast for New Warriors, which is on Freeform. I'm holding out hope for either Freeform or Hulu will do better than ABC has done with Marvel. Freeform was ABC Family, so I'm a little wary of it.
Yeah, you weren't super happy with the Cloak & Dagger trailer, so...
I was not happy with the Cloak & Dagger trailer. I'm also not happy about New Warriors being a joke. But...
Are they going to go with the Zeb Wells reality television? I know the cast is pretty much that.
Yeah, it's pretty heavily based on that, so I think they might.
They included Microbe, which
So here's the thing about Microbe. He is named Zach Smith after a buddy of mine who was friends with Zeb Wells. So it's kind of funny
to
watch
surreal.
Him. Yeah, he is now... He's a comic fan of the highest order and is watching himself turn into a TV character.
That's crazy.
Played by Matthew Moy, who's nothing like Zach, actually, but... They got Milana Weintraub, who is playing Doreen Green, the Squirrel Girl, and you don't probably know that name, because I didn't know that name, but she is the girl from the AT&T commercials, and the short-lived Yahoo show, Other Space, both of which were, she's very adorable. I actually think she's a little, sort of cuter than I would have expected Squirrel Girl. It's a little more traditional cute than I would have expected them to go. But I can see it, and people seem to be super happy about this casting. The other cast, Jeremy Tardy as Night Thrasher, Callum Worthy as Speedball, Matthew Moy as Microbe, and Kate Comer as Debris. I don't know who any of those people are.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't recognize any of those little child people.
The pictures they showed, like, yeah, it looks all right.
Is Night Thrasher in there?
Night Thrasher is in there, yes.
Does that mean we're going to get... He's actually going to use a skateboard?
To thrash villains. Are they just going to completely make fun of that? That he's like this weird, doing weird, dated 80s, 90s...
They describe him as brilliant and noble and maybe a bit full of himself.
That's not necessarily...
So they're going to go with sort of the inventor, which is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm still wary of
it,
but...
It's a weird mix, but, you know, when you got Squirrel Girl in there, you kind of, like... New Warriors are cool characters. You kind of want them to succeed.
Yeah.
And Speedball's in there.
Where are they going to fight?
I don't know.
It's not going to be the Juggernaut, huh?
No, it's not going to be the Juggernaut.
Uh-huh.
They're going to fight... They're going to fight the sadness of youth and,
have a crossover with Cloak and Dagger in episode 5.
They're gonna fight unemployment. They're gonna fight student loans.
Their main weapon is fidget spinners.
Oh man.
Next.
Finally, HBO and George R. R. Martin are an early development of a series adaptation of his science fiction fantasy novel, Who Fears Death? Not his. It's actually by Nnedi Okorafor?
Yeah. It's like won so many awards. Because of the story that popped up on my newsfeed,
yeah.
I actually put this in my queue to buy the book next.
The novel sounds awesome. It was released in 2011.
Yeah.
Widespread acclaim.
It's post-apocalyptic.
It's an African-based story that takes place in the fictionalized version of post-apocalyptic Sudan. The country's class system is divided not only by race, but by tone of skin. Light-skinned Nuru are higher on the chain, oppressing the darker-skinned Okik. The hero of the story is Anya Sonwu, a child of mixed color who was the product of a sexual assault by a Nuru man and Okik woman. Father is Dave, a powerful sorcerer, and the eye of Anya Sonwu's revenge for the injustices of her conception. That is crazy ambitious,
yeah,
and different, and I am super in.
Yeah, I thought it sounded like a great concept story-wise, so I want to read the book.
Yeah, after maybe next week or next whenever you get around to reading it, Nick, let us know how it pans out.
It was nominated for the Nebula in 2010. It was nominated for the World Fantasy Award. Oh, it won the World Fantasy Award in 2011. It was nominated for the Locus Award for Best Fantasy Novel. This sounds really interesting, and I had never heard of it, and... If I read books anymore, I would read it.
Well, and also, I mean, with George R. R. Martin helping develop it at HBO,
yeah.
I mean, I guess he's moving into that sort of realm of developing instead of writing.
Honestly, if he just puts his name on a thing, that could be producing, and that's all it really needs.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. Like I say, it's early. We're probably looking at 2019, 2020 before this ever happens, but... the novel.
It'll happen right there along the second season of Westworld.
Yes. No, the second season of Westworld, they have a trailer coming out of San Diego.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
I did not, was unaware of that.
Yeah, second season of Westworld is moving right along.
I honestly feel like we're going to get a ton of announcements at San Diego next week. We're going to get a Runaways trailer, probably.
Yeah.
We're going to get, maybe a new Warriors trailer.
We'll probably get some stuff leaked out next week ahead of the con.
Yeah.
So next week and the week after will probably be huge weeks for podcast news and also for comic releases. So next week and the week after, we expect a lot of sort of big news and comics and stuff when we do the podcast. As opposed to this week when the comics were not as great for us. We had trouble finding our favorites.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a minute when we talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of July 12th and also for last week, July 5th, if you think snuck in. The last couple weeks, while there have been lots of stuff released, I think we've been sort of low on the enthusiasm in as far as that goes. We all had some trouble picking stuff this week.
I think it's the natural ebbs and flows of it. We also, I mean, there's kind of... The big stuff tends to hit when the cons are hitting.
Yeah.
And so we're probably right on the cusp of some really good stuff. And there's been good stuff. It just hasn't been stuff that I've been after.
Yeah, that's where I'm at, too. It's not that there's not good comics released. It just wasn't hitting me.
Yep.
Last week, my favorite book was Unstoppable Wasp, which I think nobody reads. Literally no one reads.
And I'm going to pick this week a book that I picked 80,000 times.
Yeah.
But it was an amazing issue.
I'm going to start because I've got a couple new ones.
Yep.
So I'm going to start with Calexit number one, which is a new Black Mask book I've been looking forward to.
Did you say Brexit?
No, it's Calexit.
What?
Yes, so this takes place in a California where a sort of right-wing fascist-type president's been elected, and California has had to step up.
Just kind of project...
they're the sixth largest economy in the world, as if this kind of thing would ever happen. This kind of thing,
right.
It's obviously very...
Use fictional. Your imagination... Throw the book a bone, just
yep.
try and predict, imagine.
But it basically, it opens with this sort of setup of there was a the United States passed this sort of law where immigrants had to go back to their homes, and California would declare itself a sanctuary state. This sort of war developed between the cities and the more rural aspects, and now the National Guard is infecting the cities, and there's a resistance. Like I say, it's all very, very unbelievable. It does not seem at all plausible.
What is it, space opera?
But, so it takes place in a California that is sort of somewhat occupied, and the story revolves around...
It's a very thought-out version of it, by the way.
Yeah.
They did not just, hastily imagine this scenario. There's a map in the beginning that shows exactly how California is divided up.
Yep.
And I also like this book, and some characters I really enjoyed kind of as the leads in their conversations. That's a lot of the sort of the what's going on is revealed through their conversations.
The main two characters are a courier who's sort of a drug dealer.
Like a black market guy.
But he describes himself as a courier.
Right.
And a girl who is an immigrant who was adopted, but that adoption was in California, so they don't recognize it. And then a third character who's sort of a interrogator, fixer type from the government, who's going around doing pretty horrible things trying to find this girl because he doesn't want her to start a revolution.
Right.
And they all intersect, and the guy who's like their bad guy reminds me of Christoph Waltz's character in Inglourious Basterds.
It was very much like that, I found.
He's very evil, very aware of his evil, and yet super interesting and
kind of likes to draw out the verbal torture.
But yeah, it definitely you like this character even as you hate him because he's a fascinating character. And then the other story is sort of about these people, you know, moving around in LA. The art is really nice, and what the whole vibe of this thing for me is DMZ.
Yes.
It reminds me a lot of what I liked about DMZ.
Right. That is to say, Vertigo's comic DMZ by Brian Wood, not some actual demilitarized zone somewhere.
That'd be a weird thing to remind me of.
I'm just saying, not everybody may know that comic. It was a little under the radar.
But yeah, I honestly worried that this would be either too goofy or too on the nose.
Right.
And, you know, it's none of that. It's actually very well thought out. It's got really strong character work, really, really nice artwork. By a new name to me. I don't know this this artist, but Amanke Nahopan.
Okay.
But I really like the art.
And of course, it's an actual glimpse of about 2-3 years from now.
Yeah, it's a little too real. It is a little too real. But it's also just a.
I think what make this is the kind of thing that could seem like not approachable. But I think the fascinating characters and the interesting dialogue and stuff is what will lead people into it.
Yeah, it's less of a dire read. It's not like when you're watching Handmaid's Tale and you're like, this is really good, but I have to put this down because I want to kill myself.
Right.
It's not quite that. It is a little breezier than that, but it is. It's really good. I liked the premise, and I thought the execution on it was excellent. Nick?
Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and talk about both of my picks.
That's because they're the same pick.
Because they're the same pick.
Same pick, different weeks.
So I think Dave originally picked the first part of this story arc called Intelligence in the book Detective Comics.
Yeah, it was the one that kicked off that you had pointed me to, though, that was a
more focus on Azrael.
And yeah, who I didn't even realize had joined the sort of Detective Comics crew.
Yep, and that story continues in 959 and 960.
What was the deal? Was he being hunted by some sort of rogue elements of the...
Well, it seems like the Order of St. Tomas has been kind of overthrown by sort of maybe... one or two people, and
I was gonna say radicals.
I mean,
they're already.
Well, I mean, there are, I'm sure, a hierarchy of radicals in amongst the radicals.
Right.
So, the highest order of radicals.
The radicalist of radicals.
The radical.
You haven't seen that since some 80s dude was doing BMX bike tricks.
Exactly, but basically, the structure of the Order of St. Tomas has changed, and a new Azrael has been put into play, and. This is a more artificial intelligence robotic, because that is the pure form of God's wrath, I guess.
See, okay. Is the idea that it's sort of, I mean, I don't know if they get into this, but like, that it's removed from human ego
and they definitely go there.
The dangers of somebody making some sort of moral decision and...
Yes, so you get more of that kind of nature is explored, more of Azrael's sort of wrestle with his own humanity and his own sanity, which I thought is really interesting. And also we get Batwing.
You're rapping there, his own humanity, his own sanity.
Sure. And also we get more about Batwing and sort of that he's formed his own tech company that...
Which is funny
because his father is like...
Lucius Fox,
head of Wayne Enterprises.
It's weird. As the other character, the original Batwing, I couldn't get interested in. Somehow you attach him to Lucius Fox and make him a son, I'm much more interested in.
I'm the same way, yeah.
And I actually have liked the interactions I've seen with him. And of course, this guest stars, notably... Well,
I'm gonna get to that.
Okay.
But I just there's a lot of action involved with this new... Azrael, which I think is called Ascension, This giant kind of robot that is that they're fighting
with a name like Ascension and its robotic nature. I definitely want to see it beaten up and destroyed.
I was wrong. It's called Ascalon, not Ascension.
And how do you spell like it? An angel name.
A S C A L O N.
Okay, yeah, it's you're right. It sounds like some kind of weird angel name.
Yeah,
but yes, like Dave was about to say, it does the first issue guest. Appeared as
the big reveal was Zatanna,
and that's sort of the second half of the story where we're seeing Bruce Wayne and Zatanna sort of interact years ago when Bruce was training,
which all goes back to the animated series. That's where that was all introduced.
I don't think that had ever been a thing until then. Yeah.
So you see him sort of learning sleight of hand, which he can't quite master. Mm-hmm. It also is tying in with some of DC's bigger events right now with the stuff with Metal. And
is it?
Yeah, there's some stuff that
really
about Zatanna and sort of her ability to kind of see the world. Since she's magic, she has the ability to kind of manipulate it at world, and she has the ability to see things that other people can't. So he's coming to her for answers.
Okay, interesting.
But I honestly really love James Tynion's take on Zatanna, and what I was saying, sort of. Her trying to ground herself in reality and not sort of give herself to the magic, which kind of unhinges people. It's a neat idea, one that I haven't sort of seen played around with too much with her. Just gives her a bit more layer. And then the artwork in here
The art is nice.
The art is just fantastic.
It's not that... Is it the same person who it's been for a little bit?
I think it... Yeah, I know. It is... It's
Detective Comics has had some of the... It's not the Eddie best Barrows, art this of the whole Keenan? Rebirth.
Yeah, I don't remember who...
Yeah, I don't know who that artist is. Is Detective Comics the best of the Rebirth books? I feel like it might be.
It might be. Alvaro Martinez. I don't know.
It has been the most consistently good one, I think, for me, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's been consistently good. I still think, like, the Superman books have been pretty good. And
I fell off of it when they did the thing with Tim Drake.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to forgive them and go back.
Well,
I would definitely peek in on... This is a good one to check back in on. Because, you know, I kind of had two... although I was always tempted to check back in because the arts remained so uniformly good. And it's not like I didn't expect that they were going to do good stuff afterwards. It was just I think neither of us particularly liked that development.
And I love the team dynamic. I love seeing like Clayface and...
It's a good mix.
Yeah.
All these characters.
That arc, they sort of lost Robin Batwoman and Spoiler. Like Red Robin and Spoiler were the ones I was there for.
Yeah.
And then they're both gone, and I was like, oh, maybe this isn't for me. But I do like everybody else that left. I like the idea of bringing Azrael in, and I like Zatanna being part of it for a while. So, yeah, I'll probably go back and check in on this. It sounds like it's good.
Dave, what is your pick?
For the umpteenth boring-ass
God,
time.
How many times can you pick this book?
Kill or be killed.
Yep. I choose kill.
You know what actually impresses me about this book?
Yes, we do, Dave. You talked about it 10 times now.
No, I'm going to tell you something different. No, actually, what impresses me is that it has not fallen into some sort of place where it's just like, you know, you when you casually expect something to be very good, even very good can be a little bit boring.
Yeah.
But he keeps throwing me off the trail by kind of changing up his approach. So, for instance, the story does not always stay with the lead guy every single moment. And just in the off chance that you haven't listened to a previous episode, this is a guy who, because of a demon who seemed to save him, he envisioned it when he tried to commit suicide. The demon demands that he basically pay tribute for his saved life by killing a person like a month for it and forcing him to try and start becoming a vigilante, essentially, and going through all these difficult practical things.
Seems kind of odd for a demon.
Well, the demon has been kind of quiet and but it reemerges in this issue. Although still, again, with the same question of like, is it possible this is just a mental break?
Yeah.
He actually takes medication for various things.
Yeah.
It would seem very possible. And you know, Brubaker is not, like, trying to surprise us. He wants to play around with this idea.
Yeah.
But the thing that was different about this one, what got it, immediately was kind of interesting, is, and this, interestingly, this is another comparison to Death Note, by the way, is we see this in the beginning. Some of his killings, people, basically detectives and FBI types, are starting to notice the patterns. They're starting to realize that this is a single person who's committed some of these murders. And they are starting to try and draw the best connections that they can. They don't have the information that we the readers do, that a demon is making him do this, and that he's having to try and like find people around him who he thinks might be essentially worthy of murder. And so they're trying to do the best guess they can based on the handful of bodies they've found on what the connections and the links are. And sometimes they're kind of, like, very wrong. And sometimes they're like, well, they're sort of on the right trail, but for the wrong reasons. And it's really interesting. There's also some subplots with some of the cops going on. So they themselves are a well-defined investigation lot. One of them is the lady who like originally sold to tabloids that this was like a serial killer going on. So she has suspect motives, but she's clearly going to play a major role throughout the story. Beyond that, the other big thing in this one is that the demon, which I thought was going to kind of drift away and to the point where we didn't see it too often, is definitely back because he's like. Essentially, he had to kill somebody close to him through a series of events. And he's ready to stop doing it. And if that means his death, he's also considering maybe now is the time. So that was really interesting. There's a thing where he's kind of wallowing in self-pity and he goes and stays at his mom's and gets high and plays video games and detaches from the world. And you get to see a little bit of his, like, kind of nice old mom, and she's just trying to be there for him and has no idea what she's getting into.
Yeah.
Like all these scenes were super interesting scenes.
This is the end of the second arc, too, so there's a big stinger at the end.
It makes sense. There's a lot that happens in this issue. It was one of those, as a sort of chapter finale or, arc finale.
So is this... Do we know how long this is going to run? Is this going to be more like Fade Out and Fatal? Or
I would guess
this...
all his books run a certain amount of length. They tend to run about 2 years. So we're probably at the halfway point, would be my guess.
That sort of makes sense. It does seem like he's, like... There's, one of the interesting things about this is that notion of like, well, if you had to kill somebody, how'd you go about it? It's morbid but interesting. It's like anybody's ever watched old Hitchcock movies know that about half of them, that's the premise.
I'd probably poison their water. Go ahead, drink up, guys.
What?
I really like the colors in here.
And so in old Hitchcock movies, I don't know if this was just like the parlor conversation for everybody in the 50s and 60s, but they would family members while they're just, having chatted dinner saying like, hey, you know how I would do it? And they start going into this crazy detail. And yet, he's exploring the kind of grittier version of, like, could you get your skills up to the level it needs to be? Right. What if you killed somebody who has connections to the mob? How do you stay out of there? How do you protect your loved ones if there's a possibility of being discovered?
Right.
It's, like, endlessly interesting notions in there for something that I thought might get kind of played out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like if we were at the halfway point, that could be very satisfying. There'd still be lots of interesting stuff to explore, and then you wrap it well and stay kind of short and sweet, though.
Yep. That's the thing. Brubaker never announces when he's ending. Never announces how long a series is going
to
be.
It's probably a smart idea.
But he always runs sort of. He always goes to sort of contained length.
Yeah. What was Fatal?
Fatal was 24 issues.
24 issues, okay.
Yeah. And Criminal was long and it was sort of ongoing, but it was also different story arcs.
Right.
He does not tend to do super extended runs, which is probably a good thing. He doesn't, unlike, say, Warren Ellis, who promises extended things and then just disappears, Brubaker knows going in, he does one or two projects, stops those, and then does other ones.
Yep. He seems to have figured out what his niche is and has gotten quite good at it.
Yep.
So anyway, Killer Bee Killed number 10. It's, endless versions of the same thing. Check this out. And actually, we do sell it all the time.
Yeah.
People are interested. It's probably going to end up one of our better-selling Brubaker series overall. So I'm very happy with how the book is doing. But if you haven't checked it out, check it out.
Yeah, Dave's going to keep picking until you check it out.
I'm going to keep picking until you check it out.
You, person listening right now. I'm talking to you.
Are we doing follow-up picks?
I'm the only one who has a follow-up pick. So.
That's kind of true.
I just want to mention Mage, The Hero Denied, number 0. This is a $1.99 book. It's sort of a short... it's interesting because Mage is a book that has not been on the stands for like 15 or 20 years. And we didn't ever know that we were going to see Mage 3. There was a long gap between Mage and Mage Volume 2 where a lot of people were like, oh, he's never going to do it. It became sort of a running joke. Mage is Matt Wagner's sort of semi-autobiographical story. His character, Kevin Matchstick, looks like him.
Yep. But it's an urban fantasy.
But it's an urban fantasy. It also mixes in the Arthurian myth. His character is called the Pendragon. He's got a baseball bat with lightning powers called Excalibur.
Yeah.
He had Mirth, who was his Merlin. It's definitely a riff of self-published comic books combined with Arthurian myth and superhero elements. And so the first story arc was basically about him, you know, being a young cartoonist, but also it's, you know, Kevin Matchstick's a young guy who discovers he has this power inside of him and all that kind of thing.
Do you think maybe it's all true and Matt Wagner is the Pendragon?
It's possible. The second one was all about him finding romance and sort of discovering who he was. The third one is an older, balding Kevin Matchstick, and it opens with him dealing with a young punk calling himself the Steez, who is a energy skateboarder dude, and basically he's a stand-in for all the young punk Image comic guys. And it's funny because I don't want this to be a book about how young punks these days got no respect and all that kind of thing, because that's just an old man griping.
Yeah,
but it's definitely done with affection toward this character. He's like, oh yeah, he's, you know, he thinks, you know, step back old man, I'm gonna deal with these monsters, and but there's more to it than that, and Kevin helps him out. But it's a non-costume superpower urban fantasy book that it reminded me why I liked the book quite a lot.
I mean, this is a book that basically anybody who's read it since, you know, it broke out in the 80s when, you know, the same era that like the Ninja Turtles were rising up, and there were some pretty very viable small press superhero comics and sci-fi stuff like Grimjack that like people who were reading. You know, it was kind of like the dark horse of the early days. It was a big book. You know, this is pretty notable. But it had, until this arc, it looked like there was not a particular ending that it was going to get.
Yeah. Well, and then it rose again in the 90s. That's when the new one came out. And
right.
Now we're, you know, the closing era of the 2010s, and he's finally wrapping it up. So I'm super excited about this. I know a lot of the old school fans will be. I'll be very curious to see if any new fans pick this up, because I do think it's timeless. I think people will enjoy it. Mm-hmm. The first trade is out this week, collecting the first of six parts of the previous one. And
I believe they did do an incentive price on this of $2. It's like a slightly breezier preview issue.
It's just a little tiny issue.
Yeah.
So, it's worth checking out. And I would say if anything in this sparks an interest for you, go back and check out the trades, which they are going to be reprinting.
Yep.
So, also on my list this week, Amazing Spider-Man number 30, which is more of a Doc Ock and Hydra versus Spidey, and has some really good stuff in it. Weapon X number 5, which continues the Weapons of Mutant Destruction story, and is really fun. I think we all really like this one. It's got some great moments with Sabretooth and Domino, and Amadeus Cho teaming up with the Weapon X team has been kind of fun. New Superman number 13 starts a new story, which Superman of China needs to put back the Justice League of China to face down the new Emperor Superman, who is basically causing trouble in Shanghai. This is a really fun book, and this is another really good story arc. And then finally I want to mention the first trade of Curse Words, Charles Soule and Ryan Brown's story of a superpowered wizard, superpowered celebrity wizard in New York, named Wizard. It is, like all Image books, $10 for the first volume. Really fun, and just gets more fun as it goes along. So I highly recommend this one. Nick, what else is on your list?
Just a few to add. Deadpool 33 continues his tie-in to Secret Empire and dealings with his daughter, which has just been really fun, and also more telling of Wade Wilson's true character. Old Man Logan number 26, which continues the Maestro story arc and his band of Hulks invading our universe.
Yep,
I guess.
Yep.
Hulks, why you gotta be that way?
You know, and they're just Hulks. It continues the story. We're seeing as it unfolds. I really like what Ed Brisson is doing here. Dark Days, the casting, which is the next part of the prelude to Metal.
That's DC's big their summer event.
It's kind of the dark multiverse rear its ugly head against our regular DC universe.
Yep. It's got all kinds of crazy stuff going on in this.
It's a weird team. It's like Hawkman's in there, but also like Green Lantern with Duke and the weird the kid who's like part of Batman's crew. And it's an interesting mix of characters, and there's nods to like Despero gets a nod, and There's a few sort of characters referenced here.
There's
a big Hannibal Lecter Joker type thing going on.
Yeah, there's a huge sort of things at play. Like, you know, any good DC crossover big event, there's tons of stuff happening. Very much got the Crisis on Infinite Earths type feel
yep,
to it.
Yes. Yep.
Then Jean Grey number 4, which the last one had her confront Namor to deal with how you deal with the Phoenix Force. This time, well, Thor has never dealt with the Phoenix Force, so I'm sure he's battled it at some point. She goes to talk to him about things.
Why doesn't Namor know anything about the Phoenix Force? Was that Avengers versus X-Men?
Yeah, he was taken over. He was one of the people
Phoenix
taken
5.
Over. And he was like the only one to come out unscathed by it, and that's why she sort of goes to him. And I think that is actually all that I've got.
Dave, anything we missed?
You let me tell you, or let me know if you have already mentioned any of these, and I just wasn't paying attention. Did we get Spider-Man 2?
Nope.
So a few years ago, they did the miniseries Spider-Man that had the first sort of major meeting between Peter Parker and Miles Morales.
Yep.
But I think there's a lot of curiosity, you know, more interest about Miles going on right now, since they did kind of do a little tip of the hat to that in the new Spider-Man movie. So this is the sort of follow-up team-up between them, and I feel like some people are probably going to be interested in that. Let's see. Did we mention the American Way?
Nope.
I just figured this is because the guy is the dude who wrote the what's that the big movie 12 Years a Slave.
Yep, John Ridley.
It's sort of like superhero stuff in the night. This is a sequel to a previous series he'd done. But I think it should stand alone, and it's sort of like politically charged stuff in the incendiary 1970s, but with superhero stuff. Featured in.
Yeah.
I feel like some of the people who liked JMS's Squadron Supreme or Supreme Power, whatever you know it by,
right.
Might be interested in that. I have to mention the weirdness that is the Centipede comic.
Yep.
Max
Bemis, who I can't remember who he is, but he's somebody.
Yeah, did we decide he wrote that Worst X-Men Ever comic?
He did, but I feel like he's done some other stuff. Like, he's a mainstream guy
somehow.
This
is a kind of an ambitious and strange take on the old 20 Atari video game Centipede.
Yep.
For, you might remember from arcades from 1982 if you were around then, or if you've ever seen a movie in which arcades from 1982 were featured. Centipede, I haven't had a chance to fully read this yet, but if you want to see somebody try and weave a video game into a story that has a little bit of depth to it, actually, they've been doing these Atari ones, this and the... what's the other one, Randy? That's the fantasy one where they took the old...
Sword Quest.
Sword Quest, yeah, the lost Atari 2600 game, a legitimately lost game. And I do find it interesting to see them rolling through these properties. Let's see, on the trade paperback side of things... Shade the Changing Girl from the DC's Young Animal line gets its first collection. I've only read like the first couple issues on that, but I did enjoy it. So I think maybe it was the Young Animal book that I was most drawn to. So y'all should check that out maybe. And then finally, people have been watching trailers and stuff for Luc Besson's upcoming sci-fi movie Valerian, which... We're all hoping will be another Fifth Element, but who knows?
Yeah.
But it's based on a famous European graphic novel series that's been running since like the 60s, and they just started reprinting that. And so the first hardcover volume of the original Valerian stuff is out. If you want to find out what the deal was with it, that's
all right.
Everything I got.
All right, we'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk the Big Sick in sort of non-spoilery capacity because Nick has not seen it yet. And then we're going to do our spoiler review of Spider-Man Homecoming. All right, so we're going to talk a couple movies here. There's Nick covered Baby Driver last week, which
yep.
I still have not a chance to see, and I'm super excited to see. But instead of Baby Driver, I sort of accidentally threw it out to my Facebook friends, like which one I should see between this and The Big Sick. And everyone was like, you should go see The Big Sick, which I did. And David's seen it, and he really liked it.
Yep.
And I'm glad I did, because I actually thought it was really, really good.
Yeah, mild spoiler warning for Spider-Man. I didn't love it for Spider-Man Homecoming. And part of it like is actually not even the movie's fault. Part of it was just like a little bit of burnout on sort of superheroes, superhero movies and stuff. And so I kind of wanted to see something like The Big Sick just as like a counterpoint to that.
That is quite the counterpoint.
It is quite the counterpoint. Just something grounded in humanity. Yep. It's a drama comedy. Lots of comedy in there because the guy is literally a comedian. Yep. What's the name of the?
So this is the true story of how, and this is sort of a spoiler to know this. Kumail Nanjiani, who co-wrote the movie with his wife Emily Gordon, this is the story of how they met.
Right.
So it is. It's.
By the way, if I were going to do that in a non-spoiler way, I would just say it's the true story of their relationship between a comedian and somebody.
Yeah, I feel like it's not meant to be.
It's pretty heavily part of like some of the promotions for it, though.
It's not meant to be a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But it's produced by Judd Apatow. It's directed by Michael Showalter, who is the guy who wrote. He's done a lot of writing. He wrote Wet Hot American Summer and the Netflix series, and worked on Children's Hospital for Adult Swim, and most recently did Search Party for TBS, which I don't know if you've seen, Nick.
I haven't seen it.
I've heard it's really good. I believe this is his first movie direction.
Mm-hmm. A pretty good start.
But he directed a bunch of TV. He directed an episode of Love. He directed an episode of Grace and Frankie. He's directed a show called Your Hole. Basically, he's a guy who's done a lot of comedy and sort of indie stuff on TV. This movie, I assume, is like a big wide release, but it's not in any theaters in Austin. It's in
it's at the Draft House. It gets wide on Friday. If I'm not mistaken,
because it was only at the Draft House and like the Art House theaters.
Yeah.
When I talked to my nurse about it, she had never heard of it.
Yeah, that's, you're like, you should know about movies that have the word sick in them and have hospital parts in them.
Well, I just thought this was, I mean, Kumail Nanjiani's on Silicon Valley and is sort of a notable comedian at this point.
Yeah.
And I thought this was like one of those big releases, and I think it did do very well. But apparently it is sort of under the radar, which is too bad, because they showed, when we went to the Draft House, I don't know, Dave, you probably saw the same things I did, which the intro was all these romantic comedies, Say Anything and When Harry Met Sally and that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And I am not a romantic comedy guy. I generally find them annoying. But this is that rare exception where I'm like, this is what romantic comedy should be.
You don't like Say Anything?
I love Say Anything. I love When Harry Met Sally. Those are the exceptions that prove the rule.
Okay. Right. So are you saying that this is more in those veins?
This is more in those veins.
Well, then that bodes well, because all those movies I love.
Yes.
I love
Say Anything. I've never seen Say Anything, but I do love When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
And this has a great supporting cast, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Scott.
The meet cute between Kumail and Zoe Kazan, who plays Emily, is they do a really good job with that relationship.
Yep. I felt like before, you know, there's a part in it that if you've seen the trailers, you know that there's a sort of a notable thing that happens that puts a severe strain on their relationship.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she gets sick and winds up in the hospital.
Yeah, she winds up in the hospital, and there's like some weird and funny and interesting family crossover between his family and her family, and do they know about each other, and do they meet, and all of this stuff. Even prior to that, it's an interesting take on modern day dating.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of just sort of like, hey, this is kind of what it's like to be, you know, 20 something dating, trying to figure that out.
Well, and mixed into that is that Kumail Nanjiani is a Muslim from Pakistan.
Yep.
And his family expects him to be arranged marriage.
Yeah.
And
I'm just remembering the preview about his family trying to set him up with the woman who knows he loves X-Files.
There's a big runner on that. She's actually...
Yeah, she's all like, the truth is out there.
Yeah.
That great. Is, she's from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yes, she is. I recognize
and
her.
And she's... It's a nice little moment with her. There's like a string of women that she's... That's actually played not just for laughs, but also for pathos. It's sort of a...
I felt bad for these poor women.
Yeah, but I also felt bad for him and his family. Like,
right.
It's not just a thing where you can say, Mom, Dad, I'm dating a white girl. Like, that is a you're not going to be in the family anymore kind of thing. It's like a big deal. And her family, when we meet them, are going through some rough times as well. But her family is Ray Romano and Holly Hunter. And they're both, like, honestly top-notch. If nothing else in the movie worked, they would be the best part of it.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They've got some real depth to them.
Yeah.
They're both characters who are a little different than they seem on the surface at first, who their interactions together have a lot of, like, they're heartfelt and funny and sad at times, and all that stuff you want in a good sort of more serious comedy drama.
It doesn't shock me that Holly Hunter is great, because she's always great.
Holly Hunter kills it, man. She is... The bit with her in the comedy club
was
amazing.
But Ray Romano is sort of reinventing himself a little bit lately.
Yeah.
And I know he's about to be in the reinterpretation of Get Shorty.
Yeah.
But this one does.
He's really good. He's exceptional in it.
He's really good here.
Playing, sort of a guy who's a little bit of a doormat in some ways. I feel like he kind of can't sort of assert himself easily, and he's also in a relationship. He's a little bit more the dope, you know. Yeah, he's a little bit more of a.
I got a little Homer Simpson from.
Yeah, a little bit of a Homer Simpson, but in that same Homer Simpson way, kind of a sweet guy, sort of a likable guy. No character in this is thrown under the bus as far as like this is the villain or this is the guy who you want to root against.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was no the romantic comedy trope is usually some kind of they're with the wrong guy or something like that. The reason I like something like When Harry Met Sally or Say Anything or this is that the trope is not an artificial choose one person or the other. It is sort of a...
It's the messiness of it all.
Yeah, it's the messiness of it all. It reminds me of what I liked about Master of None on TV.
Yeah.
And I thought, what they did with Kamal's family, his brother Naveed is great.
Oh, yeah.
The bit where they're at the batting cages was really good. It reminded me, it was like what I liked about When Harry Met Sally's Bruno Kirby character.
Yeah.
But he's a very different character in that he's the more traditional of them. He's basically the guy talking sense. Instead of the guy talking sense about the, why are you trying to be this guy... be friends with a girl that's crazy, which, you know, in the 80s I guess was a crazy thing. he's like why are you trying to date this Western girl? You need to
grow a beard and make mom happy.
Yeah And it's the same role, but it's a very different approach to it,
right?
And there's his comedy buddies, the like three.
Oh yeah, they were actually all good, like little side characters too.
There's some great stuff. His roommate is like terrible at comedy, and he's sort of their friend who's like, hey, maybe instead of that joke, maybe you could quit comedy forever.
Yeah,
there's like that's super
that,
mean.
That dark comedian, dark comedy shows up in some places.
Yeah, it's like everything I liked about, say, Master of None and Homecoming King and even Louis is all in this movie. It's got that tone of like.
Yeah, I feel like
humor,
Master of None and Louis and those kind of comedy shows are definitely the ones, the hallmarks. Yeah.
I expected to like this, but even watching the trailer, I felt like I had seen the whole arc of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think to some extent that's true. Like, there's not a lot of surprises in this plot. But it's all done really well.
But what I found was, though, at a certain point in it, not too far in, I kind of became captivated in watching the ups and downs.
Yeah.
And I realized that it is kind of one of these more about journey than destination things. And so I was still, getting, emotionally throttled all over the place as I was watching it and feeling very compelled and not like, okay, so when are they going to get married? It wasn't like, come on, let's get to it. In some ways that completely fell off my radar as something to I wasn't waiting for anything to happen because I wasn't sure. There's also always how they structure a movie and what they want to end on, what they think is important, what they what the difficulties they're going to focus on are, and you get so caught up in that it's just. It is not important if you know how the things wrap.
Well, no, and they earn their moments. It's very sweet. There's some very tear-jerking moments, and they earn all of those moments.
The audience I saw it with, I noticed, was really into it.
Yeah, I thought this was fantastic. It's definitely one of the best movies of the year.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
Now let's talk Spider-Man Homecoming. So, first of all...
Which 95% of the people are probably going to say is also one of the best movies of the year.
I'm going to give three warnings. First is our traditional spoiler warning. We're going to spoil stuff. We're going to talk about Easter eggs. We're going to talk about everything. If you haven't seen it, go ahead and see it. We're going to spoil it now.
I'm going to say bare bones. We all think it was very well made.
The second warning I'm going to give is that a lot of you are going to be yelling at your podcast in about 5 minutes because Dave and I did not love this movie like apparently 95% of America and 100% of comic fans did. So there is going to be some snark. But the third warning I will say is that Dave and I may soft sell our opinions a little bit because we're trying not to buzzkill everybody. So if you really want to know what we think, come talk to us outside the store and we'll give you the unvarnished truth.
With swears in it.
But the truth is we're probably on the spectrum we always are, which is, Nick, you loved it.
Yep.
I liked it but had some issues, and Dave liked it but had more issues than me.
Yes.
I mean, I had issues at times, but nothing that I felt was detrimental to the overall experience of the movie.
So it is being declared like the best Spider-Man movie by pretty much everyone.
That's accurate.
And I agree with that. I think Dave is the only one in the room who does not agree with that.
Yeah. I like the Raimis over them. I will say I like Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker better. Because he actually feels closer to the comics one to me, even though I acknowledge that they like left out some major portions. Like, he's a little weirdly melancholy, Tobey Maguire-ish. They forgot to write Spider-Man as quipping completely almost in those. But I think because Raimi had a big sort of sense of humor in a lot of just the presentation of things, it sort of balanced a little bit. But I did feel that he was more a little closer to what I wanted as Spider-Man than the Spazzy Kid in this, who did very good as Spazzy Kid.
I think Tom Holland is still closer to where nobody's gotten the Spider-Man I want except for the cartoon Spectacular Spider-Man.
He's closer to Ultimate Spider-Man, right?
That feels pretty clear to me.
I mean, honestly, this feels definitely like Ultimate Spider-Man. I mean, you could take that because in the credits, Brian Michael Bendis' name was number one above, like, Stan Lee and... or Steve
was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes sense.
They used a lot of what Bendis brings to the comics for the movie.
I couldn't figure out why Dwayne McDuffie's name was in the credits, and then I realized, oh... Damage Control.
Yeah, Damage Control is his.
Yeah. And I want to quick say, although I somewhat checked out of the movie actually at a certain point, I loved how it opened. I actually thought the opening, which was essentially the villain origin in a very concise scene that cleverly brought in Damage Control, cool way, cleverly set up a villain motivation that I really kind of hadn't seen before.
Yep.
And one that I kind of bought, I was like, oh, I have some sympathy for this guy.
Yep.
And it even managed to set up how the Spider-Man universe in the MCU, or Spider-Man's corner of it at least, there's going to be some heightened bad guys with alien tech from the old from the Avengers defeat of the Chitauri.
Yep.
I was like, man, those are all one string of great ideas after another, and it gets done quick.
I think that might be my biggest gripe with the movie is that the villain it's like the original Batman 89.
Yeah.
It's that weirdly
more compelling.
Weirdly, that movie also had Michael Keaton. but he got subsumed a little bit because Jack Nicholson's
joke compared to Birdman at some point too.
Yeah. But Michael Keaton's Vulture it's the best story. His story is the story I'm interested in. And I found him very sympathetic even as he's, you know, I understand his motivations.
Yeah.
And I liked that character. I thought it was the best take on the Vulture I've ever seen.
You were very understanding of a dad willing to kill for his daughter.
How weird.
Just
how odd.
Something randomly, there's somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Maybe you liked how he dressed, maybe something else.
That's what it
somehow
is.
Somehow you connect it.
I do like to go out and fly on wings.
You liked the little the fur collar that he had.
I do like the fur collar. this was the best version of Vulture I've seen. I like the old man Vulture in the comics.
Yeah.
But this version had a lot more depth. He's also arguably one of the best Marvel villains. Like, other than Loki, I don't know anybody else is on this level.
I agree.
And I thought that was really cool. I also love they brought in, like, the Tinkerer and the Shocker and Scorpion and all those guys referenced in here.
I honestly love that this brought Small Crime to the MCU.
Yes.
Because,
it's a weird thing to say, but I know what you mean.
But, I mean, we haven't had any of that in
It seems like, you know, if the Avengers get together, it's got to be something big.
Yeah.
Right. But this introduces
other people
us to traditional heists.
Sure.
And
if I'm not mistaken, Ant-Man, other than when he went up like against Yellow Jacket, and then one of his fellow heroes, it's not like there were a lot of super criminals running around for him to deal with.
No.
He was mostly dealing with kind of heisty tech stuff.
Yeah, it was corporate espionage.
But here we had like kind of there's a sense of bad guys are running around in lots of different places that at least have some bits and pieces of elevated tech.
But with the Tinkerer making like tech left and right and selling it to who knows what. You could easily have him
supplying other people in subsequent Marvel movies.
Yeah.
You could have, you know, there's other bad guys who make tech and stuff like that from different, you know, other comics. You could have him working with those, partnering with them, you know, I don't know who all, I'm blanking, Machine Smith and whoever.
And the clever thing is they've been doing this for 8 years. So even though the plot involves them stopping this big heist, that was all this technology
It retroactively builds in a history to the MCU.
And that is really cool. And I think that is my biggest complaint and also the biggest thing I liked about the movie is that as a The Vulture and His Crew movie. It's a great movie. The problem is the Spider-Man stuff. I'm not as into Spider-Man. Not bored. I felt like they were trying too hard. I felt like the humor was a little over the top. Like I like Ned, but I felt like we were too a little too winky at the camera about him being the guy in the chair and all that kind of thing. And
kind of meta.
Yeah, it was a little too meta. It was a little too, hey, we're going to get Spider-Man right. Look, we're getting Spider-Man right. Hey, you like quips? He's making quips every 5 minutes. It was too much.
Now, well, come on, Randy. He made quips more than every 5 minutes.
That's actually true.
I liked it because it sort of felt natural for the spazzy, I guess, what, 14 or 15-year-old he's supposed
to be?
He's
supposed to be 15, I think.
Yeah.
But Spidey isn't that. Spidey has always been sort of...
Sullen Peter Parker, wisecracking Spidey.
Yeah, and also...
And we say always, though, but that did start to change a bit over time.
But, I mean, he wasn't joking as Peter Parker. He was only joking as Spider-Man.
Yeah, but also...
He was the brunt of the joke.
I think, unfortunately, putting him in a tech magnet school changes things. Because then you had Flash as a sort of modern-day rich bully... You had...
They reinvented Peter, all the supporting cast.
I mean, which I Peter loved. They tried to make it out like Peter was still an outcast, but he's with, like, one of the hottest girls in school when she's interested in him. There's another cute girl who he's friends with. And they're trying to make them as losers, and I'm like, you know what? This doesn't seem so bad. They all seem
right.
like...
Flash is...
In the hierarchy of,
I
like,
agree
kids.
That, yeah, I mean, like, they didn't have anything going on. They didn't have girls yet. He and Ned were still trying to find...
Right.
You know, dates and stuff. But not that I necessarily want the old jock trope back, but Flash did not come across as a threat in this.
There was never any worry that, oh, Peter, you know, Flash was a joke. And the thing I liked about Peter, and maybe this again is speaking to my own history, Peter was the guy who got bullied, but who was actually the cool guy the bully actually liked, you know?
Yeah.
You had this Peter as outcast thing, and you had him... dealing with the death of his uncle, who is never mentioned once in this movie, ever. I don't need them to do the origin, but no one says Uncle Ben's name even once in this movie.
Yeah, they don't. They mention
an incident. They for sure decided to make Tony Stark Uncle Ben.
Yeah, and I think that's a weird call. I like the notion of Tony Stark being Peter's mentor in a way. I like the sort of the temptation of this is the direction you could go and become this guy, and for him to have to veer away from it. I think that's an interesting story, but I thought they leaned too heavily on it, and I would have liked some influence from his other uncle, basically, his other father figure, even if whether it's in flashbacks, or whether it's Aunt May mentioning it, or something.
They were pretty clever about how they worked some things in at times, including the, you know, the famous scene from the old Lee Ditko era, where Spider-Man lifts all the collapsed debris off.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I feel that they would have been clever enough, had they wanted to work Uncle Ben in there. I think they just were like... it's sort of... I mean, honestly, I feel like they were at least... very consistent about that we're going to rework everything. We're like, we're going to rework his motivations. We're going to rework all of his supporting cast.
Yeah.
We're going to retool how his powers work, to be honest.
See, Dave, this is part of why I still rank this higher than the Tobey Maguire stuff, is because I feel like the reason they had to do this retooling is because they screwed up the origin twice. I go back to what they did, and the problem is that none of those stuck.
Well, and then you know, the Andrew Garfield one, they went weirdly in an opposite direction where they made like his parents like spies.
Yeah.
And
well, that's from the comics.
I mean,
but
I know that's from the comics. They focused on it. They brought and it became too weird. I think
what's interesting is the Maguire one. Although I feel like he himself was almost a little overly vengeful. Like he really didn't even try and save the crook when he like falls out of the window and stuff like that. Right. But that was otherwise pretty beat for beat what happened in the comics.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. For whatever reason, it didn't have the energy I wanted. Partly that's Raimi's weirdness. It's not always
my
thing.
Yeah. I can see that. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say the execution of it was perfect.
Yeah.
But it did follow all the major stuff. But Watchmen followed all the major stuff and somehow was still dissatisfying.
I think that's ultimately why I liked Homecoming, is it has the vibe. People describe it as this is definitely the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it feels like the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
So all the stuff that... I sort of complain about like it being too quippy and, you know, there's a lot of nods and that kind of thing. The kind of thing that annoyed me at the same time is also what I wanted from it. Because I like that it's sort of light and breezy and light on its feet. I liked all the weird stuff with his AI played by Jennifer Connelly. Like, it's a weird thing to do with Spider-Man, but it was fun, and I got the appeal of it.
Yeah.
And there's
a little meta there, because Jennifer Connelly's married to Paul Bettany, who is Jarvis.
Well, him using crazy, like, taser webs and all this kind of stuff, and having a battle suit like Iron Man's, and it feels right to me for the Marvel Cinematic Spider-Man. But at the same time, it makes it feel less like Spider-Man.
It's not completely adherent.
It's not like I was playing in Arkham, one of the Arkham games, and I was getting the character upgrades.
Yeah.
And like almost like meta jokes about like if you had gotten like the God codes and stuff for that, you know, and like without earning them.
Yeah. Well, like the interrogation mode thing. We talked about this off mic before, Dave, is that like if he had just come in with the growly Christian Bale voice and immediately turned it off, that would have been a funny gag. But it went too long.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was the pattern for the entire movie. Like, every joke went too long. Now, everything was like war is walking.
I'm curious to hear, Nick, what were your things that you most liked about it?
I mean, I like Tom Holland, and I think that's a big part of it. I mean, I liked Michael Keaton as well, but I liked Tom Holland, and I liked his portrayal.
It's interesting to me how many people rally behind him, because I would say for most of us, except for Ultimate Spider-Man readers, which is a lot of readers at this point, but... when I came in on Spider-Man, he was in college and struggling like with graduate stuff.
Yeah.
And then to some degree or another, he's been out of high school, you know, since like the 60s. So he had several decades of essentially more decades as an adult than as a teenager. But people are really like enjoying him as a teenager again, even though that hasn't been as big a thing in the comics for a long time. Except Ultimate Spider-Man.
Yeah. And with Miles. And
do you think it's just that there was kind of something different? Like, we've seen endless college-age Spider-Mans on screen now.
Yeah.
Or it seems like, and it was kind of
they
just
did the
nice
high school thing with the Andrew Garfield stuff, even though that felt completely forced and bad.
That's one thing I wanted. I wanted more high school stuff. When they did the thing where he decided he wasn't going to be Spider-Man anymore and decided to go to Homecoming and get all that, I liked all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I would have liked a little more of the high school stuff. It was only there as a distraction from being Spider-Man, which I understand was the point.
Yeah.
That for him, that's what he was feeling. But I would have liked... I guess what I would have liked is for the Tony Stark split to have happened a lot earlier in the movie and had a lot more of the movie with him being Peter Parker and struggling with being his own version of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I feel like that arc got rushed and compressed a little bit.
And I kind of liked that arc. So, I mean, it worked for me. It didn't work for you guys.
Do you feel without having Uncle Ben to explicitly sort of state the theme of kind of power and responsibility, do you feel like they accomplished that, Nick?
Yeah, I think so. I mean...
I feel like that wasn't the theme.
I mean, I don't know if that
What would you say the theme was? Like, let's say Ant-Man. What was Ant-Man's theme about? Redemption?
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward.
I think the theme about... I think it's the theme
just
of Homecoming.
Finding yourself.
I think it's the not wanting to grow up too fast. I think that was the... It was basically the choice between...
Being happy with who you are.
Yeah. I think that was the theme of it, yeah.
And not buying into this possible bigger thing that is looming on the horizon.
Not being in such a hurry to grow up.
Yeah.
Peter Parker is not usually somebody who has sort of a life's goal. Mm-hmm. He's usually portrayed as somebody who's struggling to get by. He might hope to become a photographer or hope to one day have time to, you know, become a chemical engineer or whatever. But he was generally like, I got to be responsible, use these powers and stuff, keep Aunt May alive.
Yeah.
This was weird because he was way into becoming an Avenger.
Yeah.
Like, that was his one and only life's
goal.
Which
is the exact opposite of how Spidey was in the comics.
But it's a different interpretation of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And this Spider-Man has different goals. And living in the MCU, the Avengers are sort of the pinnacle of... If you've got powers, that's where you want to be.
Sure. I understand it. It's just... It's, again, it's not that it's bad. I actually think it was a very good version of Spidey. My version of Spidey that I want, I'm thinking I'm never going to see, other than in the comics, which is kind of a disappointment.
Yeah, Spider-Man has always had a certain outlaw connotation.
Yeah.
Not just because JJJ tars him, but because, you know, he's... I guess back in the day, he was at times blamed for deaths, like Gene DeWolf or whatever. And he was the guy who, like, the Avengers kind of didn't want to be around.
Yeah.
They were like, sorry, Spidey, we don't deal with outlaws.
See, I think that's one of the things that, again, and I'm mad at the other movies for this, because they burned JJJ up, they burned up the Stacy's plot, they burned up Mary Jane. All those stories have been done, and done poorly, and as a result, the MCU's not touching them. And so, there was no Jonah Jameson in this, There's no, like, police, like Gene DeWolf or anybody like that in here for him. Like, they're, none of that stuff. They don't want to get into any of that stuff. So it's all sort of pushed to the side.
But they did
and
replace them.
I missed its absence.
Find things to replace him with. So,
I mean,
is Ned, by the way, is Ned Ned Leeds?
They don't give him a last name.
Oh, okay. But the Ned Leeds, famous, notably one of Spidey's friends off and on in the comics. Yeah.
I think if you also added some of those things in, it would have been too bloated. And for a movie that already ran 2.5 hours.
I agree. I understand why it's not there, but I did miss it.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? But yeah, you know, they worked in some neat stuff with Miles' uncle.
Yes. Donald Glover as the Prowler was an interesting take.
He was good.
But he was still playing Donald Glover. I wish the Prowler's... That's not how I think of the Prowler.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's definitely a movie incarnation.
I feel like they definitely brought in a star-studded cast, but in general, either the star-studded cast didn't really get to stretch themselves very much, or they didn't try to get into the character. Like, Hannibal Buress always feels like he's phoning his roles in, honestly.
He
felt like he was phoning it in here.
I don't know that that's fair to say. I think you hire him for that laconic delivery.
Yeah, I don't know.
He was meant to make you laugh. He made me laugh when he did the... he's showing Captain America instructional videos, and he's like, I think this guy's a war criminal now.
He's very the funny. Disinterested gym teacher.
But, I mean, it's kind of like saying, like... I mean, like, you know, Bruce Campbell was the wrestling announcer in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He was Bruce Campbell, but I don't think he was phoning it in.
Yeah,
I just think he just plays Bruce Campbell.
Bokeem Woodbine, who played the Shocker, he was fine, but that guy was one of the scariest, awesomest bad guys in Fargo Season 2, and there was nothing to it here. Now, that's not him, that's the writing.
That's the writing. That.
But that's a shame, because I like, when they cast him, I was super excited.
But that also means, I mean, they didn't kill him.
Yeah, they didn't
kill him. That definitely is gonna lead into something more, and he can maybe have more to do in the next one. I mean...
My exceptions here are, Jon Favreau is happy. I loved every minute of him. I love that character. Him being sort of the put-upon guy who's like, Tony Stark basically like, hey, this kid's your problem now. I loved that. I thought that was super fun.
I love that Favreau's still involved in these things and produces, and now he got a pretty huge role in this.
Yeah, I thought he was great, and I always like Happy. I always like Jon Favreau. And Marissa Tomei as young Hottie Mae Parker, I thought I was going to hate that. I kind of love that character.
You larbed it.
I larbed it.
Yeah, she did a really good job. I think we would all say that Keaton was doing some exceptional villain work.
Yeah,
he's always good though. Yeah. I mean, I don't think he's made
this was a level of this was some of his best work. I thought he did a great job here.
Right, I think it is somewhat rare to give the villains that much room to breathe these days. I think there is, and, you know, it's an interesting counterpoint because they gave him probably too much room after Nicholson's performance in Batman 89.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, we get it. You love the villains.
Yep.
But yeah, Batman himself got short shrift in those. Now they've done such a good job with some of the heroes, you know, in like the Avengers movies and all their ancillary ones, that you're like, oh, I want to spend more time with those guys than the villains sometimes. So I understand how sometimes they end up with underwritten villains.
Yeah.
Here it was nice to see a villain who, you know, actually had some presence and depth.
Yeah. I also, the big thing at the end of the movie... Marissa Tomei's performance of that, I loved that. And I also that's a direction I want them to go with the characters. I thought JMS did a great job with that.
Basically the identity not being secret to the loved ones.
Yes.
Yep.
I'm glad they did that, because I really like that take on the characters.
And I think we're also all a little bit tired of the superheroes have to lie trope.
Yes.
You know, that your loved ones get endlessly put upon. It's one of those things that frustrated me as a kid, the same way that Charlie Brown always being missing the football frustrated me, like on some very deep level. You know, every time he would lie to MJ and she would be like, ah, Peter, and of course it happened with Lois and all that.
Yeah.
And I think it was all part of sort of the originally the old sort of nerdy power fantasy of it all, that, oh, it's the only reason you can't get with the girl is because you're being so noble.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I think we're ready to move on to that point and acknowledge the need for friendship and family and all this stuff. And keep the secret identities. You don't want Green Goblin coming to the door.
Yeah.
But
going to the Vulture's door is a case.
But you can tell, you know, honestly, I also credit Buffy for doing that. And eventually her mom found out and they handled it in a really smart way.
Yep. I do want to mention one last thing, which is that twist of the Vulture reveal.
Yeah. I didn't see it coming.
I did not see that coming. And
is that also just the weirdest coincidence ever?
Really. It's not the weirdest. I mean, there weren't a lot of other coincidences. You're allowed one.
Yeah, but that the girl you have a crush on is a supervillain? Like a one in a zillion people?
I mean, he was operating in his same area. It's not the craziest thing.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what the mitigating circumstances was. And then, you know, it was a good moment. It was a good moment.
At no point did I think, oh, what a cheap shot. I thought that was a great reveal, and it added a bit of depth to their relationship. And weirdly, the Vulture's never been like one of his A-list villains.
No.
But
no.
I think it elevated him to sort of Green Goblin level.
I didn't love the look of the Vulture as Vulture.
Oh.
I thought it was interesting.
I liked the idea behind it.
I liked this version.
I just didn't like sort of the actual armor and stuff. In general, I thought the action scenes were good, if actually a little more comedic than I wanted them to be.
I actually thought the action got muddled sometimes.
A little too frenetic.
The finale, the big battle at the end on the plane.
The mirrory plane. They were being very showy there.
Yeah, I thought that got a little, not Michael Bay-y, but leaning toward that direction.
Right, like kind of overly long and like I can't quite tell what's
because
happening.
Because the Marvel Cinematic Universe is so good with action, because we get things like Civil War and Winter Soldier, I have a heightened expectation of it. And so when it's lackluster, I notice it. And I do think that the action scenes were a little lackluster.
Well, and these are a little on the smaller scale of action as well. So it's a different type of animal.
Yeah.
Because Civil War has grand action sequences. Sure. Yeah. And all the other ones, we've built up to these team action
Cap
sequences.
Cap taking out dudes in an elevator was an amazing scene.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody is going to remember
that. Yeah, I can't remember the choreography of this particular fight. I remember it just being sort of a mixed bag.
Right. Honestly, they probably got more out of the Washington Memorial. Was it?
I thought that was...
That was not bad.
That was probably their most notable scene. Had some very good stuff in there, I think.
Yeah.
I liked his little gliders.
Yeah, that was a... Interestingly, not obscure, but very underused thing from the comics.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, like I say... I'm still going to be there first day for the sequel on this. I'm looking forward to Michael Mondo's Scorpion if they go that way.
I'll be curious to see where they go, if they do bring in some themes like Uncle Ben and... or if they want to completely sort of stay away.
I don't see
them
bringing it up at this point.
Yeah.
I mean,
Unless they can find some way for him to reach out from beyond the grave, or to reveal that Uncle Ben isn't dead in this universe, and that the thing they were talking about was the divorce from Uncle Ben, and he's still around. And
oh man, that'd be crazy.
They've got a plot point to make out of it. I mean, you could probably do it.
It'd be weird.
It'd be weird.
I also didn't love their MJ.
I liked her.
Because there was nothing for her to do. Like MJ's MJ should be a pretty striking character, and they wanted the big reveal of, oh, call me MJ to be a big thing. But we all saw that coming, right? That was all, no, really?
No. I don't know, I didn't know, I remember some certain actress was playing her, and I did not know, but like, once it began, what was the name of the girl?
Michelle.
No. I'm sorry. Who was the girl he was pursuing?
Liz.
Liz. And right. And I just thought, okay, they're going with a version of Liz Allen. Oh, I thought they were doing MJ. Yeah, whatever. I wasn't particularly thinking about it.
I knew because Zendaya was playing the character. I knew that's who that was. And I thought making her sort of a weird nerd in their group is a weird take. And it's a re-envisioning, just like all of this is re-envisioning. And MJ is such a striking character, I thought this was a weird take on her.
I do get the... I mean, again, I have to kind of understand their logic on it.
Yeah.
The nerd getting the super babe or whatever. Did Spidey date MJ in high school, or was it when he was in college?
Wasn't until later.
Yeah, I kind of feel like he kind of... just the fact that you went from Ditko's art to Romita Sr., and Romita kind of drew a more handsome Peter Parker. It was kind of like he grew up a bit. He got a little bit out of his gawky teen years.
Yeah, I think so.
And there, MJ made a little bit more sense. Yeah, of course, he drew that. I can picture, of course, the first panel of MJ drawn by Romita Jr.
Right.
Or Sr. In high school, if he's going to like get the girl or whatever, it'd be pretty hard to buy a geek of his caliber, the spazzy Lego kid, landing a... pretty beautiful, and in this case, super very intelligent woman like Liz. I honestly never felt the chemistry between them. Like, I didn't see what she saw in him. All he did was let her down throughout.
See,
the whole thing.
I don't know. I don't buy, because it's the nerdy girl thing is a bigger thing now than it used to be, and so I feel like to have a
right,
nerdy
like they
cute
could have
girl
connected,
is a different
but do you
thing.
Think that they were showing them connecting?
Not as much as they should have. No,
that's
I agree.
That's just what
they,
I felt
they took
like.
Shortcuts. On
I could have bought into it, but I needed to see them like working on a project together and kind of bonding a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think they could have done
also
that.
Silly kids don't know what love is.
That's true. That's true.
And on that note, we will close out for the week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
Yo, Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.